Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Brian Cox.
I'm Robin Ince. The Infinite Monkey Cage is back and we are starting the series with a whole show about trees with Dame Judi Dench. What else we got, Brian?
We're going to do What a Gas with Mark Miodovnik. Unexpected Science History with Rufus Hound. I don't know what he knows about unexpected science history.
Well, that's the unexpected thing. He hasn't got a clue.
No, I'm hoping we're having some experts on there. Exploring with Annika Rice.
No, that's just one of your dreams. The other night I dreamt I was exploring with Annika Rice. And also Alien Life in Glastonbury with Chris Lintott.
Yeah.
Infinite Monkey Cage.
Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
It's week 4 in the world's smallest broiler farm.
It says it's going to take an hour to assemble this. Come on. We can do it in 20 minutes.
I'm Chris Van Tulleken, and I'm raising chickens for meat. 4 of them. Well, there were 5. One came to a sad ending last week when she went lame and had to be put down.
Left. Side panel, outer left.
But it's a big day for the 4 remaining chicks. It's time for them to move from my study, where they've been wreaking havoc and pooing on everything, into a proper little coop in the garden, which arrived flat-packed a few days ago.
There's a horizontal bit with holes in it there.
Some assembly required.
Which goes like that.
I've got 2 of the fastest-growing breed in the world, Ross 308. Nugget and Layla are growing fast, particularly Nugget. He's about twice the size of the others.
Now the roof.
Foxy is my remaining Hubbard. They're a slightly slower growing breed, but he's not much smaller. He is a lot more active than the Rosses, though, much more inclined to climb onto the kid's shoulders and run around. And finally, there's Forks, the little naked neck. He's the most adventurous of the bunch. I feel like he's desperate to get out. He sits on the radio and stares out the window.
Okay, that's good.
Letting them go outside means, in effect, my broiler business has gone from an intensive indoor system in my study to a tiny free-range one. My chickens can scratch about my small garden in the sunshine, eating bugs and grass, and being a bit more chickeny. I feel good about that, even though, eventually, I'm planning to eat them. Why am I doing all this? Well, I'm a doctor, an academic, and a broadcaster, and I've spent a decent chunk of my career thinking and talking about our diets, what the food we eat is doing to us, how we might make better food choices, and whether, in fact, we have a lot of choice about what we eat.
That's the door. Look at that. That's good.
Why do we eat what we eat? Where does our food come from? And how does it arrive on our plates? I'm digging into the world's most popular meat, chicken. I eat it all the time, and yet, like so much of what I eat, the reality of the way chicken is produced in this country is pretty much a mystery to me. Trying to get a little more understanding of the process by doing it myself and by talking to people who do it a lot better than me. In the last episode, we explored welfare, how the birds we raise for meat in this country are looked after and why that matters. I learned a lot about what my little flock needs to keep it happy, but there's another aspect of their care that's been on my mind. In the quest to eat a good diet, we sometimes get ourselves in a tangle about what good actually is. High welfare meat or solid environmental credentials. Could it really be true that when it comes to chicken, you can't have both? From BBC Radio 4, this is Fed, with me, Chris Van Tulleken. This series is Planet Chicken. And in this episode, the ethical consumer's dilemma. Is it possible to raise a bird that's high welfare and good for the planet too?
I don't know quite how to express this strongly enough. I think what's going on in the global climate is just scary. And we need as an industry to be on the front foot.
I've come to another high-intensity indoor broiler farm, this time in Bedfordshire. Farmer Peter Kendall is passionate about his role in the environmental battle, and his passion is infectious.
We need to collectively work out how we put more British food on more British plates with a lower, hopefully net zero carbon footprint.
Being environmentally friendly can mean lots of different things, and Peter's taking a lot of different approaches here, and he talks me through them. First up, there's sustainable energy generated on site. He's got these massive biomass boilers and a ground-sourced heat pump, which are used to heat the chicken houses. He's got solar panels, and he's trying to get a small wind turbine up too. He reckons the farm overall is 60% self-sufficient in energy now, and the chicken sheds themselves closer to 80%.
Primarily we're wheat farms. We grow a lot of wheat, which we also feed to the chickens, actually, and we use the straw to heat the sheds as well.
So while you've been talking, we've walked down... How long's this shed? 150 metres?
109 metres long.
109 metres.
By 20 metres wide.
Okay.
And we've got eight of these sheds in a row, basically housing just over 350,000 chickens.
Really? There are 350,000 chickens on site?
Yeah.
Can we see some of them?
We certainly can. Tuesday, just dip our feet through here. Okay.
I certainly approve of the disinfectant foot bath.
I'm an infectious diseases specialist.
Are you?
Yeah. I'm a virologist, actually.
Right. So I did agricultural economics. So I do bullshit, you do science. So we're going to be a million miles away. We're going to go in this door here.
Okay, so shall I just go in?
Yep, in you go. We'll shut the door behind us.
We can't go into the chicken shed itself, but we head into a side room with a big viewing window.
So this is the viewing gallery. Look!
They're tiny, fluffy little yellow chicks. 44,000 of them.
It's quite a spectacle, isn't it?
As we approach the glass, there's this extraordinary ripple of movement through the flock. It's like a Mexican wave of tiny, fluffy ping pong balls. It's quite a sight.
They're very adorable, dashing around, some of them dozing in quite sweet ways.
These fluff balls are Ross 308s, like my Nugget and Layla at home. And they're raised the way the vast majority of birds in this country are raised. Intensively. They're kept indoors all their lives, then slaughtered young at either 4 or 5 weeks. To be clear, they meet all the legal welfare standards, and farmers like Peter are keen to tout their welfare credentials. But these are the birds that activists will tell you are the lower welfare birds by comparison. Higher welfare birds would be free range, allowed to go outside, and would live longer too. For Peter, this isn't just about keeping costs low. This is his second sustainability tactic. In his view, growing chickens like this is the least environmentally damaging.
If we had fewer birds in a shed, it would have some environmental impact by producing fewer kilos of chicken with the same amount of heat and shed space, because you're feeding them for longer, they're growing slower.
So you use more food per bird.
More food per bird. So you can do this system, I think, remarkably sustainably. My ambition is to produce this chicken net zero. That would be where I want to be.
And if you were trying to achieve net zero to produce chicken meat by using long-lived, free-range birds, that would be much harder from what I understand.
Producing 100,000 kilos, 100 tonnes of poultry meat out of this shed, with the carbon footprint that then goes with it, it's going to be really challenging to produce that. You know, am I romantic about this? No, I'm not. I'm actually trying to find a way of producing a lot of, I think, environmentally responsible food for people to consume. I like the way it integrates into my arable farm. I'm using the straw to heat the sheds. I'm using the wheat to supplement the feed.
This is the third string to Peter's environmental bow. He's running what he calls a circular farm system. He uses the poo from the chickens to fertilise his crops, in this case wheat, and then he uses some of his wheat to supplement the chicken feed. And the straw from the wheat also feeds his biomass boilers, which go to heat the chicken sheds. It's a smart system, a tight little loop of generation and consumption, which makes the farm pretty efficient, and it does bring his carbon footprint down. That's kind of what all this boils down to.
When we're looking at the footprint of a piece of food, whether it's a piece of wheat or a piece of beef or a piece of chicken or whatever, we have to look at all the things that had to go on in order for that food to be produced.
This stuff gets incredibly convoluted, but Mike Berners-Lee is going to help me get to the bottom of it.
I'm Mike Berners-Lee. I'm a professor at Lancaster University.
He's a walking, talking carbon footprint calculator.
I have written some books, including How Bad Are Bananas? The Carbon Footprint of Everything.
Finding out the carbon footprint of your roast chicken is not just about how much carbon the chicken uses. It's the carbon used to keep the lights on in the shed, the carbon used in the diesel for the tractors used to harvest the chicken's feed.
There's the emissions that might take place in rearing the animal, maybe keeping them warm.
The carbon used in the factory that makes the fertiliser to grow the straw that lines the sheds.
There's the emissions from growing any food that they eat.
The carbon in the fuel for the tanker that ships the feed across the ocean. The carbon in the packaging process. The fuel used to transport the chickens to slaughter.
And of course the carbon footprint of any fertilisers or pesticides that may have been used.
You get the picture. The carbon webs Mike calculates are mind-bogglingly complicated. How on earth do we figure out whether eating chicken can ever be good for the environment? First up, Mike's quite clear on one point. Eating meat, any meat, is always going to be carbon heavy. There's just no getting away from that fact.
The most efficient thing to do by far is to grow plants directly for human consumption. If instead you grow plants and then feed them to animals, they do all sorts of inefficient things that take energy. So they walk around and they keep warm and they metabolize, and all of that builds a massive inefficiency into the food system.
So meat is always going to be relatively carbon intensive because animals want to do all this very energetically wasteful stuff like moving around and living their lives. That's one point for the vegans, I suppose. All right, but I do eat meat, and so do most of us, at least to some degree. How does chicken stack up against other meats then?
Against other meats, chickens do quite well. They're much less carbon intensive compared to beef and lamb, for example, mainly because they don't burp up methane.
So chicken stacks up pretty well against other meats. But as I've been finding out, there are huge differences in the ways that different chickens are kept. So what's the environmental difference between a high welfare bird, a long-lived free-range bird slaughtered at, say, 16 weeks, versus an intensive bird, raised fast and killed young at 5 or 6 weeks? How do they stack up?
Well, if we just forget for the moment the fact that a chicken might be a sentient being and its quality of life might matter, what you'd be looking for would be an animal that you can get to grow very, very quickly to minimise all the inefficiencies of being alive, basically.
The sooner you can kill a chicken, the less carbon it will use in its lifetime. It's a pretty brutal kind of maths, but it checks out. The shorter the chicken's lives, the better for the environment. For me, this is really unsettling. I buy the highest welfare chicken I can, the ones that live for 12 to 14 weeks. Now I'm learning that these birds are the ones that might be hurting the environment the most, simply by living longer. Mike says that of all the factors going into the carbon footprint of a chicken, by far and away the biggest impact is what the chicken is eating, the feed.
And it takes typically something like 2.6 kilograms of that feed to produce just 1 kilogram of chicken.
This is a really important statistic that's used across the board in animal farming. The feed conversion ratio, or FCR. Basically, how many kilos of feed do you have to put into an animal in order to get 1 kilo of meat out? High-intensity chickens have a much lower FCR, but the longer they live, the higher that number goes.
The food conversion we're getting here is 1.45 kilos of feed in for 1 kilo of chicken out.
Back on Peter's farm, we've left the warmth of the viewing gallery and we're standing out on the forecourt, blinking in the sunshine. Peter's telling me his FCR, his feed conversion ratio. It's pretty impressive.
1.5 kilos of feed in to a kilo of meat out. Wow, I think that's pretty spectacular. So there's not a lot of waste. And one of the reasons you get that food conversion is the fact that you put high volume protein in, which is the soya.
Behind us, there's this range of huge three-story high metal silos in deep military green. They've got a spaghetti of pipes coming out the bottom. This is where the chicken feed is stored. Peter may be augmenting his bird's diet with his wheat grown on site, but most of what's in this gigantic silo is imported soy.
I think we'd love to know that it's all coming from a source that is sustainable, that it's not contributing to deforestation. And I think there are assurance schemes building up. There is some real scrutiny going on to where soy comes from. But boy, it's a weak link.
When I spoke to Mike Berners-Lee, he explained something that was surprising to me. The environmental story about soy is actually not that clear-cut. In some ways, it's both a hero and a villain. As a feed, it's extremely high in easily absorbed protein, and feeding it to chickens means that they grow bigger, quicker, and could be slaughtered sooner. And as we've heard, that lowers their carbon footprint. That's an environmental win. But because it's so effective, it's become a completely dominant force in the poultry industry, in all animal feed, in fact, all over the world. The huge demand for cheap soy means that much of it is not sustainably farmed. Soy plantations have caused huge deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon. It's a real dilemma for Peter with his ambitious environmental targets. But at present, there aren't really many other options on the table.
Hallo, wir sind Julia Becker und Chris Sommer vom Podcast Drinnies. Hunde sind ja eher keine Drinnis, die wollen mehrfach täglich raus und mit anderen spielen, muss jeder selber wissen. Wer so viel unterwegs ist, sollte allerdings auch gut versichert sein. Die Tierkrankenversicherung von Petolo bietet euren Hunden und Katzen Vollschutz, das heißt OP und Krankenschutz.
Mit dem Gutscheincode Drinnis sichert ihr euch einen kostenfreien Probemonat, mit dem ihr einen Monat lang alle Petolo Services nutzen, sowie eine Videosprechstunde bei Dr. Fressnapf unverbindlich und kostenfrei testen könnt. Alle Infos dazu findet ihr auf petolo.de/drinnis.
A $6 billion con.
It didn't take long for it to spread like wildfire.
You got to take a look at this really crazy gold stock. A buddy of mine got in at a dime.
Which destroyed lives and devastated communities.
Every little town across the nation, people have shares in this.
We lost everything.
And to date, no one has been brought to justice.
Somebody knows more than we know.
The $6 billion gold scam from the BBC World Service and CBC. All episodes are available now. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
So we're standing here about 15 miles from the centre of Cambridge. There's some really exciting tech startups around Cambridge looking at insect protein. There's work going on about growing varieties of peas. I grow field beans on the farm here as well. I think there is potential in the UK to grow more of our own protein. Why? To reduce our dependency on soya from Brazil.
The carbon footprint is just one part of farming's impact on the environment. There's also issues of land use, crumbling biodiversity, soil health, and the use of potentially harmful fertilisers and pesticides. And of course, there's also the problem of pollution.
I'm looking at the river now, and I'm looking at a bed that is absolutely plastered in algae that's growing on the bed of the river.
This is Simon Evans from the Why and Ask Foundation. He's a scientist, also a salmon fisherman, an otter spotter, and general river fanatic.
And you pull out this stick, and you can just see this blanket of algae. And
it's sort of fibrous green slime, isn't
yeah.
it?
Simon's here to show me how much the river is suffering, but he can't stop himself from breaking off mid-sentence to show me treasures all the way along the bank.
A freshwater mussel here. It's not a pearl mussel, it's just a swan mussel. It's been taken out here and scoffed by an otter.
Lovely.
I'm on the banks of the River Wye. I'm just downstream of Hereford at a place called Holm Lacey. I went canoeing along exactly this stretch of river a few years ago, and I can vouch for it. It really was gorgeous, clear, fast-flowing, teeming with life. But not today. It's murky, tea brown. Every stone at the river's edge is deeply furred over with a coat of sludgy green algae. Algal blooms like this occur for a variety of really complex overlapping reasons, which Simon lays out for me. Upland soils have been compacted by sheep hooves. There's unseasonal flooding. There's the death of a keystone species of aquatic plant called ranunculus. But for the sake of time, I'll keep it simple. The river is suffering because there's just too much phosphorus in it. Phosphorus that's come from poo. Human poo, sheep poo, and chicken poo.
It's 72% from agriculture, about 20% from sewage, and about 8% from other. And the problem came when we started importing animal feed to feed intensive livestock.
In soy and corn or whatever.
And then feeding it to our livestock in the Wye, and we've got a lot of livestock in the Wye. And then what that did was it brought a great wad of phosphorus into the system that then came out in the manures, and the soil can only hold so much. And then they enter the river, and then they fuel the algae that we can see in the river in front of us.
There have been a ton of articles in the last decade putting the blame for this firmly at the door of chicken farmers. This part of Herefordshire saw a huge influx in chicken farms after around 2010. And to be clear, they're mostly egg farms here, not broilers. But the really key thing was not that there were too many of them, but that they were mostly free range. You know, the high welfare systems.
In terms of the barn system, you can manage your manures. It's very difficult to manage your manures in a free-range system.
So I've seen this with the barns I go into, and the farmer just comes in with a bulldozer, scrapes out the manure. Free-range chickens, of which I have five in my garden, the idea of picking up even the smallest amounts of chicken poo from my tiny lawn would be impossible.
Yeah, it's a lot. Yeah.
And there is a lot of phosphorus in chicken poo.
So four chickens is equal to one person in terms of the phosphorus production.
So per kilogram of animal, they're producing far more.
And when you add it up, we put the population of Birmingham into the headwaters of the River Wye system and didn't give them a sewage system.
Right. Okay, that's amazing.
What do you think?
So in terms of...
In terms of phosphate production.
Phosphate production, it's the equivalent of taking everyone in Birmingham and having them all
living in the Upper Wye without a sewage system.
That's quite a powerful metaphor. Wow. Okay. How emotionally involved are you personally with the health of this river?
My wife says too much. It genuinely hurts me when things are going wrong and I want to put it right. I want to put it right.
Simon and I bundle into the car and drive about an hour north to somewhere that, to Simon, represents a potential solution. If the problem is poo, then the solution needs to come from the poo too.
Simon, the media's often pitched this as the farmers as the baddies, I suppose. What's the truth of that?
No, the truth of it, the farmers are operating within a sort of an economic framework that's set by society. They're business people, they're businesses. So if they're given planning permission to do something, then they will do it. But there is an enormous amount of environmental awareness within the farming community. And we're here at Witten Farms because Joe Hilditch, who's standing on my right, is part of the solution.
Joe, I'm Chris. Tell me, what do you do with your chicken waste?
Waste? I don't think you should be calling it waste. It is an incredibly valuable nutrient source.
Chicken poo? What do you call it?
Chicken nutrient.
Chicken nutrient? That sounds like it's food for chickens. We'll call it chicken poo.
Joe Hilditch is from Whittern Farms, a mixed farm on the very upper catchment of the Wye, near a river called the Arrow.
I'm a fourth generation farmer and we've got a highly diversified farm here. The main product we have is broiler chickens. Apart from that, we've got blackcurrant, cider apples, tourists, British cassis.
Do you farm tourists?
I do. They're very important to me.
Joe farms broiler birds for the table, Rosses, just like mine.
We've got Ross 308s. Now, hang on, we haven't. We've got Ross 508s.
Oh,
I've got no idea what the difference is. But her birds are, like the vast majority of chickens in this country, indoor birds. High intensity, grown fast, slaughtered at 40 days old. There are well over 500,000 birds here. And every 8 weeks or so, they're all replaced with 500,000 more. But none of her chicken poo will end up in the river. Once they go for slaughter, Joe scoops everything out of the huge barns. All the bedding, and all the phosphorus-rich poo, and she shovels it into an incredibly high-tech incinerator, which she uses to heat the chicken sheds. But it's not just fuel for heating.
The same product that went in comes out the other end as ash. So in 1 year, we put in 6,000 tonnes of poop, and at the end, we get 600 tonnes of ash. We know that it's 14% phosphorus, which in a year is about 70,000 kilograms of phosphorus.
So Joe's turning wet manure, which is heavy and expensive to transport, into ash pellets, super rich in phosphorus and light enough that it makes economic sense to transport them. Out to East Anglia, for example, where phosphorus is actually desperately needed.
This is barn chickens. Is it more complicated with free range? If you have chickens wandering all over the field, can you still do it?
Yeah, I mean, certainly that's a problem with free range because they are pooping on the fields and their waste is ending up in the soils and does get banned up as phosphorus.
The solution's ingenious. Of course, it would need significant financial investment to put plants like this in all the farms in the Wye catchment. But as ingenious as this solution is, it's just not compatible with birds that can live and poo outside. This problem seems intractable. Chickens are animals, and animals are, in broad brushstrokes, a climate disaster. They use up resources, burn through carbon, and poop out phosphorus, which has to be carefully managed. If we want to eat a living animal rather than, say, a plant, then the more living we let it do, the worse this problem becomes. Can there be a solution which brings it all together? Can we raise a bird that's high welfare and good for the planet? More importantly, can we do it at the scale we need to provide the vast number of birds we eat every year?
You need to have the best animal welfare standard. In addition, you need to have a production which is sustainable.
And what do people in Norway care most about? Do they care about welfare or do they care about the environment or carbon?
So I don't think you can choose. They want both.
I tracked down a company who claim they can do the impossible, raise chickens both kindly and sustainably.
My name is Hilde Talseth. I am the head of sustainability in Norsk Kylling.
I'm going to struggle with the pronunciation. Norskilling?
Norskilling, yes.
Norsk, so that's Norway.
Yes.
And then killing is chicken, is that right?
That's correct.
Norskilling, apologies to any Norwegians listening for my butchery of your language, are a huge chicken producer, churning out 30% of Norway's chickens. And Hilda says they're doing it in a way which is environmentally sustainable too. They've signed up to the Better Chicken Commitment, which Liam Hodgson told us about in the previous episode. It's a voluntary standard that holds producers to the high welfare stuff we've talked about. Slower growing breeds, hubbards like my Hey Hey and Foxy. Lower stocking densities, more space, raised with natural light. It's supported by the RSPCA. It's not a free range system though. These chickens live their entire lives inside in sheds.
I don't believe that you get better and healthier status of the birds having an outside. The biggest issues for the bird is to have a space to run around. So when we have reduced the density in the farmhouses, I see that the birds are happy.
Higher welfare like this should obviously be more expensive, but they've made it affordable by integrating the entire supply chain. They own the breeding facilities, the hatcheries. They send the day-old chicks out to the network of contract farms and they supply them with the feed. And when the time comes, these hubbards will be transported to on-site slaughterhouses and processing plants. It's the efficiencies of scale that make a process like this profitable.
What we see is that when we do things correct and when we do things responsible, we also earn money.
And is your model replicable for other chicken companies around the world? Could people copy you?
Yes, obviously they could. And we strongly recommend them to do so. I have never met a farmer that doesn't want to do the best for their birds. But you must give them the resources to be able to do so. Now our farmers, they are proud of their production and they want to show the rest of the world what they're doing. And this is also really motivating for us.
I've seen lots of ingenious solutions to the problems of chickens' environmental impact, many of them put forward by the farmers and the producers themselves. But they're all expensive. None of them are really compatible with this idea that we want a £4 supermarket chicken and we want two of them per week. I'm brought back to what feels like an inescapable fact. The problem isn't that we eat chicken, it's how much chicken we eat. We could feed the whole country on high welfare birds if we ate far, far less of them. But I'm not sure if, as a country, we're really up for that.
I think the science is really clear-cut that whether you care about climate change or biodiversity or feeding the world or all three of those things, it's absolutely clear that we need to reduce by a long way the amount of meat and dairy in our diet.
Mike paints a stark picture here.
Farmers are in a tricky situation because most of the farmers I know absolutely want to look after the environment and they'd like to earn a living. You know, there are pathways through this, and it's partly down to the farmers, and it's partly down to support from government, and it's partly down to support from us as consumers in showing our preferences in what we want to take off the shelves.
As a consumer standing in the supermarket aisles, up to this point, I've always felt good about trying to buy high-welfare, free-range birds. But all this time, there's been a trade-off that I didn't know about. If I want to eat what's best for the environment, in this country, it's Joe's and Peter's barn-reared birds that I should be buying, really. Next time. You have to know so much about a bird to make a properly informed decision about whether or not it's the kind of thing you want to be eating, what breed it is, how it's raised, and what it's been fed. The problem is, we're not necessarily being given all the information.
They will not know where it comes from, the country of origin, how it was produced, welfare standards. Nobody really asks those questions. It's all about price.
A $6 billion con.
It didn't take long for it to spread like wildfire.
You got to take a look at this really crazy gold stock. A buddy of mine got in at a dime.
Which destroyed lives and devastated communities.
Every little town across the nation, people have shares in this.
We lost everything.
And to date, no one has been brought to justice.
Somebody knows more than we know.
The $6 billion gold scam from the BBC World Service and CBC. All episodes are available now. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.